speaker this morning is an internationally recognized guitar player.
Man.
Hardly.
He's also an author, practitioner, teacher of Chinese medicine in his spare time. He's been active in the field since 1980.
That's going to be too bright for me.
Yeah, we'll see how it goes. If you want them off, we'll turn them off. It's not fun. Most importantly, you'll be comfortable. Lottie holds master's degrees in both acupuncture and neurobiology. He's a founding board member of the Acupuncture Society of Massachusetts. And in 1993, he was elected as a fellow to the prestigious National Academy of Acupuncture. And last night, you enjoyed his guitar.
Prestigious.
Today,
it closed like 15 minutes.
Please welcome Lottie Garrett.
Okay, thanks, Jack.
Just speak in a normal voice. We'll be good.
Okay, everyone can hear? That's good.
Good.
I have some error message here. Okay, that's excellent. Let's just see if this works. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you all for coming. It's great to be together. Thank you, Jack, for the generous invitation to participate.
Sorry.
Okay, so just to get the shameless self-promotion out of the way, I'll be teaching a series of 6 weekends in San Francisco over the next year and a half. It'll be very nice to meet some of you there. Actually, it's in Berkeley, but if you live on the East Coast, it's all San Francisco. And after the morning sessions and after the afternoon session, I will be at the Golden Flower Chinese Herb book booth selling my book. I just bought a few copies here, so if you're interested, they're discounted, and I'd be happy to meet you. And if you don't want the book, you can come and say hi. And I'm happy to go to lunch with people. I can't go with 500, but if there are a few people who want to really catch up about what I'm talking about, just grab me after this and we'll go to lunch. And otherwise, take time to introduce yourself. So it's a pleasure to be here. And what we're going to be talking about is integral evolutionary and spiritual perspectives on medicine. I think it's important to realize that Chinese medicine actually evolved in a culture. And it didn't evolve in this culture. It evolved in ancient China. And the ancient Chinese had values. And those values are very different from our values. The people who wrote the Nei Ching never met a woman who wasn't owned. So as enlightened as they were from our point of view, maybe not so much at a cultural level. They never met a human being who wasn't owned by the emperor. So even though they awoken to some perennial truths about the human place in culture and cosmos and in the biosphere, we know a lot more, right? Like we know that the stars aren't little pinholes in a canopy. Even Albert Einstein would have thought that the universe was only as big as our solar system. Right? He had no idea. So culture keeps evolving, and Chinese medicine now has evolved in the relative context of political, social, academic freedom for the last 100 years. And that has implications. So I think it's... Jack had asked me to talk about how you achieve extraordinary results. And I had that conversation with him a year ago and completely forgot about it until yesterday morning when Subhuti Dharmananda mentioned it. And I thought, oh God, I have to somehow tie this in. So I think you get extraordinary results by knowing who you are, why you're here, how to live, and understanding how you're doing what you're doing, why you're doing what you're doing, and never stop asking, why am I doing what am I doing? Who am I? Why am I here? And going forward in that. So what we're going to do is take a 50-minute journey through a 15-billion-year developmental context. And I'm going to try to place the emergence of Chinese medicine where it stands now, how we got here, at the dawn of the emergence of integral medicine in a historical context, in terms of East and West coming together, and just try to create a very big picture. So, we're going to put the practice of medicine in the biggest possible context that I can create, and not just the practice of Chinese medicine, the practice of medicine. We're going to consider the cultural forces of East-West integration in an evolutionary context. I'm going to present the integral model. We would only need a week for that. Engender a deep appreciation of the magnitude of the path that we are all on together as we transcend the inherent limitations of the Eastern mind and the limitations of the Western mind to create a new medicine that includes the best from each but goes further than either one is capable of on its own. And I just want to start with the appreciation that the motivation to integrate is the motive toward wholeness for both self and for patient. So Rudyard Kipling says, East is East, West is West, never the two shall meet. I think he died around 1860. Till earth and skies stand presently at God's great judgment seat. God's great judgment seat is the absolute view, the absolute, not the relative perspective. But there is neither east nor west, border nor breed nor birth. In other words, these differences, worlds apart, can be transcended when two strong men, sorry ladies, he must have contributed to the Nei Ching in a past life, stand face to face, though they come from the ends of the earth. So the two strong, in quotes, men in this context are East-West, the Eastern mind, the Western mind. And what I'm really looking at is, look, I'm on all the news groups. Any of you who read the news groups know that I'm there every day monitoring because I'm interested in culture and where it's going. And a lot of people have a lot of opinions and very few people actually know what they're talking about, but it doesn't stop them from saying a lot. So let the buyer beware. So people are arguing, we need to understand Chinese medicine on the basis it was formulated. And other people are saying, I'm a Westerner, and, you know, I can measure qi on my computer with electrodes attached to the skin, and it's all just counter-irritation. And both of these views are as silly as the other. So we need an integral view, we need an emergent view that goes beyond both the strengths and weaknesses of either view on its own. We're at a time in history now where there's no such thing as geographical isolation for the first time in history. So while these different hemispheres of the mind evolved on different continents, you just have to look at a paragraph of written Chinese and a paragraph of written English without knowing anything else to understand that the values in the mind that created them are very different. But we're living in a context of post-geographical isolation. It's one world, and it has been since the first pictures of the Earth floating in space came back from the satellites in the 1960s. So, how did we get here? Let's try to cover 14 billion years relatively quickly. So, Lao Tzu tells us, and all the great traditions tell us, that at some point, and modern physics puts it 14 to 15 billion years ago, at least in this part of the universe, as far as we know, I'm just going according to best available information, something came from nothing. Something came from nothing. So we have this big bang. All the energy, physics tells us, quantum mechanics tells us, that all the energy and matter that exists in the universe now emerged from nothing in a single point of space. So who was there when that happened? Would have had to have been us. And apparently we were all very close. And all of the, you have your truth, I have my truth, and I'm a unique individual, we were all the same individual. And it's just an illusion that we're not, but at least at that point, we existed in a single point in space, at least as potential, right? Not in this form. So within moments, milliseconds, there was a huge expansion, and there was the one, and the one was hydrogen. And then from the one comes the two, and the two was helium. The helium condensed and exploded. After about a billion years, just a billion years, and then there was light. it took 8 billion years, give or take, for our solar system to form. Another 3 billion years for life to emerge on the planet. So about another 2 to 3 billion years for consciousness to form, and then self-reflective consciousness. 100,000 years ago, there were all these naked things walking around the earth, several upright species, and they were walking together, but they didn't know they were walking together. And then in a moment, consciousness evolved, and all of a sudden, not only were they walking, but they knew they were walking. I know I'm speaking to you today, and I know that I know I'm speaking to you today, and I even know that. And there is no degree to which human or self-reflective awareness cannot stand back from itself. When you have self-reflective awareness and you can see yourself, you can get lost in the illusion that you're separate from everything else. But you also have the capacity to wake up and remember that you're actually one with everything else. And so every curse is a gift, every weakness a strength. So consciousness evolves, self-reflective awareness to just self-centric, ego-reflective awareness. Who do I care about? Me. Then I care. Then as consciousness evolves, I care about me. Then I care about my family. I care about my clan. I care about my tribe. Right? Ethnocentric consciousness. Everyone who looks like me is good, and everyone else is the evil other. Still lots of people at a tribal level of consciousness today, aren't there, in the world? What's the difference between the Hutus and the Tutsis? Size of the forehead. Shape of the nose. And if your nose looks like mine, you're good, and if it doesn't, you're dead. For no other reason other than you look different. That's ethnocentric consciousness at its worst. Mythocentric consciousness is higher than that. It doesn't matter if you're black, it doesn't matter if you're white, it doesn't matter if you're an Indian, but if you believe in the God I believe in, we're one, and everyone else is going to hell. Everyone else is wrong. But it's higher than ethnocentric, because that's just like sharing physical characteristics and skin color. Then we get to nation-centric. It doesn't matter if you're black, it doesn't matter if you're white, it doesn't matter if you're Jew, Muslim, or Christian, or a Sufi, but if you're an American, right? You're a Canadian, you're a German. That's ethnocentric conscious. That's much higher than just killing everybody who doesn't look like you, but it still leads to a lot of trouble. The most I can relate to nation-centric consciousness is at the Olympics, when I'm watching on TV, I'm always kind of jazzed if the American team wins. But if they lose, I just go, God, that was fantastic. I don't fall into tears on the floor because the Americans... But Hitler did. When Jesse Owens won at the Olympics in Germany, I mean, Hitler was crushed, right? So then we arrive at global-centric awareness. Oh, probably everyone in this room is at global-centric awareness, right? I'm a citizen of the world, right? We recognize oneness, citizen of the world. And above that would be cosmocentric awareness. When I was a kid, one of the first spiritual texts I read was called Cosmic Consciousness by a Canadian named William Buckey, who, oddly enough, published the book and 2 days later slipped on his doorstep and broke his head open and died. So that's why you all live down here in California, because that can't happen. You got brush fires, mudslides, tidal waves, and every other thing, but no snow. So when I read that book on cosmic consciousness, I would go outside and lay on my back and stare at the stars and go, whoa, this must be cosmic consciousness. It's not cosmic consciousness. Cosmic consciousness is having the perspective that the cosmos have on you. It has nothing to do with your perspective on the cosmos, or little to do with that. So what's the perspective the cosmos have on you? It's the same that you would have on a cell in your liver. Right? So put all your awareness inside one liver cell. Get to know it. How's that going? But your life depends on it. If it goes bad, you're dead. Right? What do you want from it? You want it to give everything it's got, the rest of its life in your life, for the sake of everything else, but you'll never know it. Cosmic consciousness, really, it's not abstract, it's just recognizing we're all in a process and we're all going somewhere together. And dare I say, which is not a popular statement, we're the leading edge of the process, at least in this corner of the universe, as far as we know. I tried having this conversation with my dog. It never seems to get anywhere. So, as consciousness evolves, it becomes more inclusive. It goes from myself to my family, to my tribe, to my clan, to everyone who shares my genetic characteristics, to everyone who shares my myth, to everyone in my country, to everyone in the planet, to Gaia itself, to actually my responsibility to the process of cosmic development itself. So, as we liberate the life force in people, it doesn't just go in circles, and its goal isn't just peace. Homeostasis. So stasis is illness. Homeostasis. We don't want things to go in circles. We want them to go somewhere developmentally. We want people to be able to move through these different stages and have greater integrity and be able to cognize and embrace ever-increasing amount of complexity. I'm sorry, it's cutting that off. I don't know what to do about it. The impulse to integrate medicine is an expression of the same force that has driven cosmic development toward higher states of integrity and complexity for 14 billion years. When you come to Chinese medicine and you start studying it and all of a sudden you feel whole, you realize, oh my God, this is what I have to do. It's because it's completing a dimension of yourself that really wasn't attended to in your schooling growing up. All of a sudden you say, my God, this is the whole half, at least this is what happened to me. This is the whole half of everything that I was never taught. When I went into Chinese, I wrote my college entrance essay on it when I was 17. There was no such thing as a career in Chinese medicine. I had to do it. I had to, just to be whole. It was information I needed. The impulse within us to seek, the impulse within us to seek is the impulse toward integration and wholeness. That's what we want to liberate in people. And it isn't a wounded, traumatized, and victimized impulse. It took 14 billion years for God to create big lizards, and then a meteor hits and they're gone, and he doesn't go, oh my God, 14 billion years. I think I have to go to Kripalu for some R&R. Yeah. I need a mud pack. You know what God's attitude was? We're going with the mammals. So we're the ones who are going to have to decide whether a mistake was made or not. Consciousness strives toward unity. Consciousness strives toward unity. The highest and deepest goal of medicine is to liberate consciousness from conditioning so that we effectively remove the human being as the source of the problem. Now, the human being isn't the only source of the problem. There's genetics, there's industrial pollutants, there's radiation, there are LED lamps. I feel like I'm at Guantanamo getting interrogated here. But it may have occurred to you at some point, a patient was sitting in front of you, that if only I could take them out of the picture, everything would be much better. When we liberate the life impulse, when we work with qi, when we put needles in people, when we liberate the life impulse from conditioning, there's an unabashed, passionate striving toward unity. It isn't just all about peace. The average patient, you know what they want when they come for acupuncture? If you put them in a hot bathtub, playing whatever music, probably like Yanni on a $49 boombox with synthesized shakuhachi flute, lit some incense, put up the pictures of whatever deities, had people of their chosen gender around with palm fronds, gave them a morphine and cognac drip. And then they'd say, give them a little bell to ring. Give them a little bell. And they'd go, I'm feeling a little too relaxed. Could you turn up the Bujang Ichitang? Go, wait. Some Shaya Wan, please. You get them in a perfect state, sort of like deep into the matrix. So very conservative people go to doctors to get drugs and surgeries so they can feel better without having to change. And liberal people go to acupuncturists and herbalists so they can feel better without having to change. Without change, nothing's happening. Without change, nothing's happening. Integrative change. So the movement toward integration and wholeness is the motive force of the universe. Can you imagine after 14 billion years what it must have been like for the process itself when the first eye opened at the bottom of the ocean? So it took 14 billion years and all of a sudden the universe can see itself for the first instant. Must have been pretty mind-blowing. And compare that to human beings looking through the Hubble telescope. What's looking and what's being seen are the same thing. The reason that's so moving is you're looking at your own history. That's the source. That's where you came from. That's who you are in the deepest and best part of yourself. And there, you have no problem to overcome. There's no time in the picture, there's no wound, trauma, no victimization, no more time needed to fully live and participate and take responsibility for the process that you engendered. Because when something came from nothing, was that a yes, no, or a maybe? Couldn't have been a no, or we wouldn't be having this conversation. And I don't think after 15 billion years it's a maybe. You don't go to how many times do you have to go to a restaurant to be absolutely sure it stinks? You say, you know, dear, that's the worst meal I ever had, but maybe we should come again next Tuesday and see if it's better. So integral medicine is a collective emergence. I want you to understand that the life force, the function of the life force is to go further, higher, deeper, right? Spirit has two directions of transcendence, all the way down, all the way up, and all the way up, most significantly, is an embrace of the responsibility for evolution itself, for the creative process itself. That's the reason you're all here this weekend. And I don't just mean to, you know, well, some of you probably came for PDA points, but I really think the reason we're all here is we all want to know more. Healthy person is never satisfied with what they know, and they're always more interested in what they don't know than what they do know, and we can call that humility. So there are three questions for the motive force of the universe. We know the number three is very big in Chinese cosmology. Heaven, earth, qi, heaven, earth, human. Sorry, ladies, but for the Chinese, it was heaven, earth, and man. I updated it to reflect the culture that we live in. On the pulse, we have qi, blood, and organ. We have the three luminaries in the heaven, the moon, the stars, and the sun, which are the character Shen. So the three questions, the motive force of the universe. Why are we here? Why? Because we are vehicles for the universe to awaken to itself. Right? The motive force of the universe is the question, who am I? Why am I here? How shall I live? So I'd like to talk about evolution in the context of medicine. Medicine is based on science. Science is based on shared agreements and a philosophical worldview. Folks, is science subjective? Is it?
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Science is not objective. Human beings create science based on values.
Based on values.
Whatever science is an emergent phenomenon. It's based on values. It's based on agreements. Can anyone show me a foot of something? You can't. You can show me a ruler and we can place it against it, but it's just arbitrary what a foot is. Right? How come yang is white and yin is black? Because we agreed.
Same
Just shared agreements. Okay, so Chinese medicine fundamentally is a science of function focused on interiority. Whatever the body, it's a question of, to the ancient Chinese, whether the body actually even existed. To the ancient Chinese, whatever the body is the top atom on an iceberg with an infinite sea of energy beneath it. An infinite sea of emptiness even beneath that energy that can't even be named. It can be experienced and it can be known absolutely and it can be known as self. But there are problems with discussing it. And when we discuss it, we have to name it. And when we name it, it's based on shared agreements. So, from the perspective of Chinese medicine, matter is a byproduct of consciousness. So when something came from nothing, was that a yes, no, or maybe? It wasn't a no. It couldn't be a maybe by now. It must have been a yes, a very big yes. And the question is then, who said it? It must have been us, because we were the only ones there. Must have been you. And if it was you, then what's your responsibility for the outcome? So, from that perspective, if you look at Buddha, Buddha was all about being, meditation, transcending the world. There are two directions that spirit transcends the world. And the direction of the Eastern teachings is to realize the body is an illusion, the universe is an illusion. Ramana Maharshi says, thou art that, I am that, I am that. Right? Ramana became awakened in a cave and he sat there and literally stopped eating, was starving to death. Rats were eating his flesh. The little children would go and throw rocks. And the townspeople had to come and lift him up and take him and feed him. He was so disidentified with his body. You listen to Eckhart Tolle, he says, the universe, the entire manifest universe is just like ripples on an infinite ocean. Now he's not saying anything new. He's sort of updating it for, but it's the same Dharma. It's the exact same thing. It's not saying anything new. So Western medicine, on the other hand, is a science of structure focused on the exterior dimensions of self. So from that perspective, consciousness is a byproduct of matter. It is not true. Neither of these views are true. There is a third view, which is a synthesis that goes further than either of them. We are capable at a world-centric level of development of actually awakening to Buddha's realization and awakening to Christ's realization as a metaphor for the Western traditions. So if you look at Christ carrying the crucifix up the hill and you look at Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree, these are two very different pictures. Lao Tzu says that you should spend your whole life sitting by your hut and never meet the people in the next town, though you should hear their roosters crowing and their dogs barking. But you never meet them because you have everything right where you are. How far can you hear a dog bark? Half a mile in a canyon? Okay. So that's kind of antisocial. In a global world, in a global world where we're all completely connected, right? We're all completely collected and there are no geographical boundaries. Do you think Lao Tzu ever woke up, looked at his wife and said, Jesus Christ, I just bought this abacus 3 weeks ago and they've come out with a new one and it has pearl inlay, jade beads, and a whole extra row. This is worth nothing. Who's going to want to buy this? So two very different pictures of awakening. We are capable now of awakening, actually looking through Buddha's eyes. We're fully capable of awakening to Buddha's vision, capable of awakening to Christ's vision and the Western enlightenment, and actually holding a degree of enlightenment, holding a capacity of consciousness, capacities in consciousness to cognize a complexity that neither the Buddha nor Christ ever imagined. Right? Buddha didn't want to let women into his teachings. From his point of view, women were just an inferior vehicle on the way to a male incarnation in which they could get enlightened eventually. if they were lucky enough. So aren't we at a level of culture that has transcended this view? At the leading edge, we definitely are in terms of the people sitting in this room. So let's take a moment and look at the historical expression and culture of the momentum behind integrative and integral medicine, and I'm going to make some distinctions relative to those two. Okay, this is going to be fun. Okay, so we have geographical isolation for millions of years. Millions of years. Let's start with René Descartes. He dies in 1650. His famous statement, "I think, therefore I am." What would the Buddha have said? The Buddha would have just said, "I am." What René Descartes had an enlightenment. I have no doubt that he had an enlightenment to the absolute nature of consciousness itself. And what René Descartes, when he says, "I think, therefore I am," he's locating the entire universe within the construct of the human mind. The tree doesn't exist as a tree. The tree only exists in my own awareness, in my own consciousness. We can rationally disembed ourselves from the biosphere, from the oppression of the religions. We can know scientifically and rationally about the world through studying it. We don't need myth and superstition anymore. René Descartes dies 1650. The Enlightenment occurs in 1650. Scientific rationality, scientific materialism is born. Knowing the world within the three-dimensional construct of the human mind through thinking, through measurement, through rational investigation. In 1685, the Jesuits visit China for the first time. And they bring a telescope, and more importantly, a calendar accurate to the day, based not on cosmology, but based on measurement, based on geometry, based on algebra. The Chinese hadn't formulated an accurate calendar. That's why we know Chinese time by epochs. Right? By dynasties. Every time a new emperor comes in, they have to insert 3 weeks in the calendar and start all over. So they're looking for a unified field theory of the universe. Those are those big sundials you see, the Chinese sundials with all the hexagrams and all the trigrams and all the metaphorical qualitative math on it, looking for a unified field theory. And scientifically, by this time, they've had thousands of years and they haven't come up with a calendar accurate to the day. The Jesuits bring this with a telescope and measurement, and it begins to undermine the Chinese view in the quality of consciousness that had given rise to their medicine and their sciences. So in Wilhelm Leibniz, in 1646 to 1716, he's a German who studies the I Ching with Jesuits, priests who have come back from China. And he studies the I Ching where you have a broken line, a solid line, or a solid line transitioning to broken, or a broken line transitioning to solid. And he looks at it and he has an enlightenment in an advanced calculus, which is the mathematics of change. He looks at the I Ching and invents binary math, which is the math that the computer and your iPhone is based on. It's the math that digital electronics are based on. And he writes the first holographic model, holographic theory in the West, in a scientific text called Monadology, the translation of which into English is available on the internet if you just Google it. It's the first holographic model in the West, and he postulates that everything in the universe is made of atoms called monads, and every monad has information in it about every other atom in the universe. And that's essentially the five-element model, where you have five elements, 12 officials, and each official has the five elements within them as the five element points, and every point has an image in it that reflects the whole. It's a hologram, it's a fractal. So In 1859, Darwin puts forth the first theory of physical evolution. Combined with Descartes' Cartesian thought, scientific rationality, and materialism, what Darwin has provided is the basis for humanity and for all species to have arisen on Earth without a white guy with a beard up on a cloud pulling puppet strings. He's given a physical mechanism for the evolution of the species that doesn't require any unseen and hidden forces. God falls out of the sky. Just at the leading edge, there are a lot of people who still think it's turtles all the way down. Right? There are still people who think there's a white guy with a beard up there. And I can tell you, if he is there, he's not between Boston and San Diego, because I flew and I looked. And even though I've traveled all over the world, I have yet to see him. But he could be always—he could be deliberately avoiding me. So in 1889, Kipling makes this famous statement, East is East, West is West. These are two completely diverse forms of consciousness. They have nothing to do with each other. They will never meet, but you can transcend them at the level of the human heart. However, also in the same period, though, Emerson and the Transcendentalists start reading the Eastern teachings and becoming very, very influenced by them, and creating a nature-based, basically Taoist theory in the context of the Western Enlightenment. William James, in 1890, publishes the first psychological text, first textbook ever written on psychology, predating Freud by, I think, 4 or 5 years. And he writes on pragmatism. He writes a book, he champions pragmatism as an absolute principle. And he champions the idea that despite what you say about what's going on in the interior, the proof of any idea is in its practical application in the world, the degree to which it contributes to evolution. An idea is true to the degree it helps things progress toward the true, the good, the beautiful. So any idea is real to the degree it yields practical results. And the highest practical results are the movement toward the true, the good, the beautiful, which is the direction of evolution itself. The point is to make that process consciously willed, to awaken to yourselves, to ourselves, not just as emptiness, but as the evolutionary, as the creative impulse itself in our heart. And by the way, to lose any sense of victimization, any sense of needing more time to do this. What you're saying sounds great, but I need more psychotherapy. Everyone else in here can do it, but I'm more sensitive than they are. So we have a room with 300 people, every one of which thinks they're more sensitive than the other 299 sitting next to them. And this isn't just true in California. If you tell someone in California you're talking about the evolution of consciousness, they say, I wrote a paper about that in fourth grade. So D.T. Suzuki, introduced Buddhism to the West. He lives 1870 to 1960. He reads William James and brings James's books back to his teachers in Japan, stating they're among the greatest Buddhist texts ever written. So the Dharma is beginning to cycle back and forth. Emerson and James are reading Buddhism, Taoism, and Vedanta. They're recycling that into the Western Enlightenment. And then D.T. Suzuki is bringing that interpretation back to the West and saying, this is some of the best Buddhism I've ever read. In 1929, Soule de Morant in France publishes the first Western book on Chinese medicine. And at least the first significant book on Chinese medicine. I think that Benjamin Franklin's grandson actually was a practicing physician who wrote about acupuncture, but I don't think he wrote a whole book on it, but I think he did know it. So 1929, Soule de Morant. In 1948, Jacques Lavier, a student of Morant, gives a 2-week seminar in Paris on acupuncture, and Van Buren and Worsley, J.R. Worsley, are in that class. They study for 2 weeks and do what anyone would do after studying Chinese medicine for 2 weeks. They go out and they begin the first two European schools of Chinese medicine. In 1948, Janet Trevell and Seymour Rinsler are at Cornell University, and they're doing interesting research on referred cardiac pain, you know, where you get the pain radiating down your left arm. And they're injecting lidocaine into points, and they're mapping out all the points that seem to make the pain go away, and they start to notice that the control group that's just having needles stuck in the points are doing every bit as well as the points that are getting lidocaine injected. They stop injecting the lidocaine and they start doing all this research. They map out points for pain conditions all over the body. And they're basically reinventing acupuncture. They're discovering the acupuncture points. They conclude one of their final papers saying, we seem to have some evidence that not only are the pain syndromes going away associated with the cardiac pain, but cardiac improvement might actually be being improved by putting needles in these points, and we suggest further research on that, which they never went on to do. Michael Good is in Australia doing research on people with severe arthritic conditions. He publishes a paper on using trigger points. He ends in 1952. He ends his last paper with stating E equals mc squared, discussing Einstein's theory of relativity and predicting the emergence of an energy medicine. I was on a bus reading his paper at the University of Michigan. This is no joke. I'm on a bus reading this paper while I was in graduate school in neuroscience, presenting in 1982 my doctorate proposal on using the newly invented electromagnetic imaging to study the shoe points. No break. Nobody's getting a break. You can have a break when you travel 3,000 miles to see me. So I'm reading this book. I presented my doctoral proposal at the University of Michigan Neuroscience Program on studying the cells in the dorsal horn of the spinal cord and in the brain using electromagnetic imaging and radioimmunoassays to study the innervation of the shoe points. And I was reading all this trigger point stuff from my presentation, and a man looked at me and said, "You're reading Michael Good's paper." And he was surprised. I said, "Yes." And I look at his name tag. He's a physician from the hospital. His name was D'Armond Good. He said, "Michael Good was my uncle." And I said, "Really? This guy's brilliant." He said, "Everyone in the family thought he was eccentric and nuts." So, in the early 1900s early 1950s, I think Aurobindo died in the early 40s, or maybe early 40s, late 40s. Teilhard died around 52 or 3. Sri Aurobindo was an Indian gentleman born in India. His father wanted him to have nothing to do with Indian culture because he thought it was so superstitious. He didn't want him to have anything to do with Panchakarma and yoga and all these astrological rings and all this kind of stuff. So he sent him to Oxford to become educated. Sri Aurobindo has an awakening at Oxford that it's his destiny to throw the English out of India. He goes back to India, starts a revolution, he's put in jail, has a spiritual awakening in jail, and realizes that Darwin's theory of evolution is the fulfillment of the entire Eastern Dharma. Buddhism, Taoism, Confucianism, and he spends the rest of his life interpreting the Eastern teachings from a developmental perspective, a perspective of endless and infinite development. All the traditions, all the spiritual traditions had said there's an end point, And he said there is no end point. The entire purpose of reincarnation is to bring vehicles forward for the evolution of consciousness. Consciousness started the project. The whole reason we're here is that we are vehicles for consciousness to awaken to itself, and there will be no end to that process. As opposed to Buddhism, which said there's an end. You awaken, you don't have to come back. Why? Because it sucks here. And it must have been when you got an abacus and... But, you know, when I die, the thing I'm going to miss is the next issue of Guitar Player magazine. And finding out what the new iPad is doing. So Teilhard de Chardin, to the whole... Just for the morning? Oh, Jesus. Well, look, folks, we got a third of the way through this. That was 55 minutes? I thought I was rocking. That's not fair. Okay. So, Teilhard de Chardin says... Okay, he's a Jesuit priest. He starts writing about evolution, and he says that evolution is the destiny of Christianity. The Pope says no way, sends him to China as punishment, and because he's a paleontologist, he discovers Peking man, which is the first anthropological evidence of evolution. They're really mad about that, so they make him live in Manhattan, where they figure he can't discover anything. Aurobindo says, man occupies the crest of the evolutionary wave. With him occurs the passage from an unconscious to a conscious evolution. Our duty as men and women, Teilhard says, is to proceed as if limits to our ability did not exist. We are collaborators in creation. George Harrison plays guitar, invents world music. Just read this quick. It's all on my website, nourishingdestiny.com. I gave this to the AAMA a year and a half ago, the doctors, and they loved it. And I finished the whole thing. Maybe I had an hour and a half. There's the world floating in space. One world. 1972, April 20th. Actually, 1970, April 20th, the first Earth Day. I turn 13. I go into New York. There are these pictures everywhere. I figure they've got it taken care of. Clean Air Act passes. Clean Water Air passes. Environment, the Endangered Species List passes. I'm like, good, I can relax. They took care of all the problems. I was wrong. World-centric consciousness emerges. It's one world. Pluralism emerges. Even though these relationships were described in the Nei Ching, Chinese medicine as formulated there wasn't holistic. We're holistic. We look at that and we see holism. They didn't see that way. It was animistic and it was absolutist. This chart doesn't exist in history. It was made for the first time in history in 1972, depicting the relationships discussed in Chinese medicine as a hologram. One world in space, one body, one mind, one culture, one cosmos. We're not going to get to that. We're not going to get to that. So what integral is a synthesis. It's beyond integrative. Everyone's talking about integrative medicine. Integrative medicine at its worst is sort of like, I'm not religious, I'm spiritual. There's a vision. We want to hold the Eastern Enlightenment. We want to hold the Western Enlightenment. But we are capable of a consciousness that goes further than either ever dreamed of. Okay? Far exceeding the limitations of either. Bringing the strengths of each, but far exceeding the limitations. It's not a question of is chi physical? Is chi metaphorical? It's all those things, and it's more. And by the way, just because I wasn't on that panel, I saw the particle physicist Friedhof Capra discuss what chi was at the first symposium in 1981 on acupuncture in the country, which I went to present my work on innervation of the shoe points. And Friedhof Capra and Montfort Porkert, who wrote the first good book on Chinese medicine in English. Very profound work. If you're not familiar with Porkert's work, you should go back and read his first text, The Theoretical Foundations. It's important philosophically. They were on stage discussing what is qi, and Father Claude Lar, a Jesuit priest who spent 60 years writing a French dictionary of Chinese from the oracle bones up to the modern language, stood up next to me, took the microphone, and said, "The two of you sound like a bunch of impudent 14-year-olds. I wasn't there the other night, so I can't say. So, do I have a minute left? Two? What? 1 minute. Perfect health, sincerity, honesty, straightforwardness, courage, disinterestedness, unselfishness, patience, endurance, perseverance, peace, calm, self-control are all things that are taught infinitely better by example than by beautiful speeches. So we just bypassed integral theory. I had all of that to do. What heals? I've been treating people for 28 years. What heals? I have no idea. But what I do, patients say, because the needle hurt, does it mean I really needed it? And I'm like, okay. But ultimately, even though I don't know what heals, I have absolutely no doubt that the foundation of healing is our own integrity. Right? You can't bow in at your treatment room door and leave your problems outside. When you die, you're not going to go toward the white light. You're going to keep doing whatever you're doing for the same reason you're doing it now. You're only going to go toward the white light the moment after you die to the exact degree and for the same reasons you're doing it right now. So our own integrity to that impulse, right here and right now, is what we're transmitting to our patients. Where do we go? Communication with each other, mutual respect and assumption of goodwill. I'm not seeing this on the news group, folks. I'm seeing a bunch of partisan know-it-alls who have a lot of axes to grind and are carving out their own turf. So I think it's fair enough to disagree, to have scholarly discussion with each other, to have all different points of view, but we're all in the same process, we're all responsible for the same outcome, we're all on the same ship going in the same direction, we're not enemies, and we've got to all do this together. Humility is the most important virtue. I'm really bad at it, but I'm trying. And my understanding of it is that a significant component means always being more interested in what we don't know than what we do. Nothing's written in stone. It's a joke. See, it's written. Oh, it didn't come up. Oh. Okay. Thank you. I actually had a picture of nothing is written in stone carved into a stone. Okay, thank you for your time and indulgence. Okay, man. Thank you, Jack. Always thank you for the invitation. Okay, this one's yours. And that's yours. There's the laser pointer. I'm going to leave it right there for Arya. I didn't get through that. I had 10 more slides. I need an hour and a half next time, man. Good morning.
How are you?
All right, what's your name?
I've never met you before. I'm Freddie.
Freddie, how are you?
I wasn't sure I was going to enjoy this, but I did very much so.
Good.
And you live in the East Coast?
Massachusetts.
Good, New York. I have a wonderful 75.
Uh-huh.
He's a brain like you.
Uh-huh.
Only shares it with his immediate group.
Uh-huh.
And I'm always trying to get him to teach the one.
Yes, I have a choice.
But one day, when you speak, I'm going to buy you a video. Because I'm going to give it to him.
Uh-huh.
And I think he's going to get
it. You better get him quick.
Huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I'll order it.
Yeah.
One day.
Good. Oh, this a video of me. I thought you were going to video him sharing his wisdom. Now I'm saying you better get to it quick.
No, I'd like to find me one day. If that ever happens,
sure.
The universe has it. I need to.
Thank you. NourishingDestiny.com.
What?
My book title, Nourishing Destiny.
Okay, Nourishing Destiny.
You should go buy my book. It's a beautiful
book. Golden Flower.
I think you'd like it. Golden Flower.
Thank you, sir.
Gentleman Charles. Angel.
Yeah, I go by my mom. I just, real quick, letting you know, I don't know if you've seen this book before. You heard of the Huang Jing?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. I was just letting you know that it's the 4th century. The Integral Way is what it's called.
But that is a postmodern translation of Chinese characters that have nothing to do with what I'm calling integral. But that's important because you can find books translating Chinese characters as evolution.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not what they meant. They just meant circular transformation.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing, though, what it's saying.
Yeah.
Anyway, I thought you might be able to add it to your plan.
Yes.
Pleasure to meet you.
Yes, Charles. Oh, Burlington, close.
Not too far from you.
Excellent.
This fantastic presentation.
Oh, fantastic. Well, come down and study with me.
How far are you?
4 hours. Stockbridge, Mass.
Okay.
Oh, do they? What's their name?
Well, I have one of the great parents in Pittsburgh.
Who are they?
My daughter's Jasmine. She does like flowering and garden arrangements. And my son, he's a chef. He used to work in the meat market.
At Guido's. Oh, at the co-op.
Yeah.
So okay, great.
They're both with flowering.
Very good.
They could have been looking you up then.
Good.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, I give a 2-year course there, and I'm always happy.
Is there on your website, the course, to find out about?
There's information at the Golden Flower booth.
Okay. And where are you going to be? You said signing books later on.
At the Golden Flower booth.
Golden, at noontime?
Right after this, yeah.
Yeah, go. Okay.
Hi.
That was delightful.
Oh, thank you.
I love your mind.
I needed another half hour.
I know, but all you needed to say, you're teaching this afternoon.
Yeah.
All you needed to say was come to my workshop. Everybody will anyway.
I hope so.
You didn't need to rush it. I mean, you know, as far as, wow, what a mind you've got.
Thank you.
You remind me of Krishnamurti.
What's your name again?
Leslie Goldman.
I love Krishnamurti.
I plant dreams.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, I've seen you every year here.
Oh, yeah, I know, but you remind me of, your mind's like Krishnamurti. It's so,
well, I've watched his videos.
It's
I
like
love
water
him. I gave him the pointer.
Yeah, it's good.
Jack has it. It's right there.
You going to sit in?
Yeah, I'll be here.
Introducing myself, Steve Rosenblatt.
Steve, how are you? Yes, we're connected.
We missed each other in Boston.
What?
We missed each other in Boston.
But how do I know you from the news groups?
No.
Where do I know you from?
I brought Dr. So to Boston.
But Steve, I know you from somewhere. Were you waiting to talk to me? At Golden Flower. At Golden Flower.
I'll be a future knowing.
No, but I know you.
Future knowing.
Okay. I really want to hear Aria Dasa.
While you're hot.
Yes.
Okay, so that's my artwork. How fast can a dream grow? As fast as a blade of grass. This is ancient weed of Kamo. Okay.
Okay.
Put a couple intentions on that while you're in this space.
Okay.
Okay. And plant a dream in there. You got so much going.
Okay. Do I just drop it?
No. Yeah. Put it in the soil. You've got so much going.
There we go.
I watered these dreams.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Want some?
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Very nice.
Okay.
Very good. What do you think, Tao? I hardly finished it. I had so much more and I was going. I was shocked when she said five minutes.
You were in the moment.
I thought she was trying to tell me everyone had to take a break.